Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. English is a living language. Every year, new words enter the lexicon. Creative speakers and writers gradually change the way the language is used. And Patricia O'Connor is keeping close watch on all of those changes. She has released the fourth edition of her best-selling grammar guide, Woe Is I, the Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. And this hour, we're going to find out what's new. Of course, you can also join the conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Hello, Pat.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here today. And it's been such fun for me to sit down with Woe Is I again. It's been about 8 years since I've really sat down with the book. And it's clever. It's a great read and enlightening as well.
Thank you.
Are some great reminders for me. But let's talk about some of the changes. I mean, first of all, why did you think it was time to bring out another edition of the book?
Well, the book first came out in 1996, and right away I started keeping a file of changes, thinking maybe there'll be a second edition sometime. And there was, and then I started the same thing after that, and there was a third edition that was 10 years ago. And again, I started keeping a file of things that I'd like to update. And fortunately, the publisher has been open to this and has invited me to do these new editions. And frankly, I don't know if I'm up to another one. It's a little arduous, but this time around, there were some bigger changes than usual. There are always a lot of things having to do with spelling, pronunciation, punctuation, and so on, things that are newly acceptable that go against what the previous generation of books had advised. This time, there are some bigger things. There are some changes in actual the underlying grammar, and one of them we did talk about it a little bit a couple of years ago. It made some headlines. This is the new acceptance of the so-called singular they.
Right. It's not every day that grammar changes make headline news, but
true.
We definitely heard a lot about this one.
Yeah, the kind of thing I'm talking about is when you say, somebody parked their car in my spot, or if anyone calls, tell them I'll be right back. Now, frankly, this is already the way most of us speak and write. Am I right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So what's happened is that grammarians have now recognized that using forms of they in this way is natural to English. It's not inconsistent with how the language actually works. In other words, common usage and common sense have prevailed. Now, for about 2.5 centuries, this was considered wrong. The use of they, them, and their to refer to a single, indefinite somebody or other, nobody in particular, this was condemned on grounds that they is plural and shouldn't refer to an individual. But since the 1300s, people have used they this way to refer to an indefinite, unknown person. And this was always a natural way to use they in English for two good reasons. One, English has no singular gender-neutral pronoun for an indefinite person. We have the neutral singular it, but that's not used for people.
No, it seems very rude when you do use it
true.
For people.
You can't even use it for a baby.
Right.
Which looks like a blob. Okay. Now, the second reason is that words like everybody, nobody, somebody, all that class of words, they are technically singular, but they don't mean just one person. We don't have just one person in mind when we say that. They're psychologically plural. Their meaning is, when you say somebody, you mean some people. Or when you say nobody, you mean no people. Anybody means any people, and so on. So notionally, they're plural. Now, modern grammarians recognize today what ordinary speakers have known all along, There's no conflict in using they, them, and their, them, and then themselves to refer to an indefinite word that has a plural feeling to it. So there's no need to go to use the awkward he or she substitutes, like somebody parked his or her car in my spot, or if anyone calls, tell him or her I'll be right back. And by the way, this isn't the only instance in which a pronoun is stretched to suit a purpose. The pronoun you was originally plural, and it was used only as an object, not a subject. There were once four forms of you: thee, thou, ye, and you. The singulars were the subject, thou, and the object, thee. The plurals were the subject, ye, and the object, you. So over time, the four forms were combined into one all-purpose you. Nobody ever objected to that. So we have a way of filling in the gaps when we don't have a ready-made word.
Well, and you say grammarians decided that this can now be used.
True. Normal people already knew this. Now, what I'm basing my acceptance on is when there becomes sort of a critical mass of acceptance of a usage in, say, dictionaries, authoritative usage guides, and when the explanations make sense, I consult the Cambridge Grammar of the English Language, I conduct a lot of research into this stuff before I actually go to the point of changing it in my book. So I just want people to know that this is not done on a whim, and it's not just because I'm hearing a lot of it or seeing it on the internet or any of that. There are good grammatical foundations for believing that these newly accepted usages are in fact grammatically sensible and correct.
All right, and it's time for teachers to put away the red pen when they see it.
Yes.
All right. Now, let's talk about some of the other changes that didn't
make
news headlines.
Another one that's sort of a grammatical one is the use of than as a preposition. It wasn't until maybe mid to late 18th century that anybody suggested that than could not be used as a preposition. That means that it could not take an object that was accusative case, the pronoun me. You couldn't say then me. You had to say then I. And I won't go into all the reasons why those arguments were made, but because they all kind of collapse on close examination. Than had long been used as a preposition since its earliest days, and prepositions are usually followed by object pronouns, then me, then him, then her, then them, then us, just like other prepositions after, about, under, over, and so on. And today, usage authorities have now recognized that than can be classified as both a preposition and a conjunction. So what that means for correct usage is that as a preposition, it's followed by an object pronoun. He's older than me. But you can also use it as a conjunction. So in that case, it's followed by a subject pronoun. He's older than I. Or you could add the understood verb if you want. He's older than I am. So there's no incorrect way to use than. And as I've often said, when you're in doubt, maybe you should just use what comes most natural to you, because we do have built-in instincts for grammar and usage, and sometimes we should trust our instincts.
There are some changes that are, I think, easier to accept than others, and we probably all mm-hmm. have different ideas of what they are.
Right.
One of your changes is about using there is with a plural compound. And that one is a lot harder on my ear, but we don't, that doesn't mean I have to use it. But can you explain this change and how we would hear it? And probably a lot of us use it without thinking about it.
Right. Now, it's still incorrect, and it probably always will be, to use theirs or there is with a plural noun, as in there's dogs in the yard or there's vegetables in this soup. That's not correct, and that's not the kind of subject-verb agreement I'm talking about. I'm talking about when theirs is followed by a compound subject. In other words, there's chicken, vegetables, and rice in the soup. Now, you have three nouns there in that as a compound subject. And by the way, when a subject or a clause starts with there, it's only a phantom subject. The real subject follows. So if you say, there's chicken, vegetables, and rice in this soup. Years ago, you would have been told that that was incorrect because those three nouns add up to a plural.
Mm-hmm.
And technically, a compound subject like that would be plural. And you would say, there are chicken, vegetables, and rice in the soup. But now grammarians are recognizing that you should have a choice. You can follow the formal rule and use a plural verb. There are chicken, vegetables, and rice in the soup. Or you can make the verb agree with the closest noun. There's chicken, vegetables, and rice in the soup. You see, the closest noun there is a singular, chicken.
Right.
So that's a little hard to get hold of, but many people do that already. When they follow there with a compound subject, they seem to make the verb agree with the closest part of that compound.
Instinctively. I've always thought when I hear it, it's like somebody changed their mind about the sentence halfway through, which very well could
true.
Be the case.
Because we don't plan our sentences when we're speaking.
Mm-hmm.
We're not William F. Buckley Jr.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Patricia O'Connor, our English language expert. She has just published the fourth edition of her best-selling grammar guide, Woe Is I. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Patricia O'Connor. She is a regular on the program as our English language expert, and she's just published a new version of her best-selling grammar guide, Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. She also blogs at grammarphobia.com, and you're welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And this year, or this hour, we're talking about some of the latest things in the English language, some of the things that Pat felt the need to update in this latest edition of Woe Is I. And Pat, I want to dig into some more of these, but we do have a number of people on the phone who want to be a part of the conversation. So let's go to the phones, and then we'll get back to some of the shifts that we're seeing in the English language in just a couple of minutes. Brad is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Brad. Oh, maybe Brad's not there anymore. Let's try Mary Lou in Iowa City. Hi, Mary Lou.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Back in my day, we would say, she graduated from college. Today, more and more, I'm hearing, she graduate college.
Yeah.
This is grading.
Is it grading.
To drop the from?
Well, in my book, what I say is that usage is on its way into acceptance, but it's still questionable. It's not there yet. So there are still three bona fide ways to use the verb graduate. He graduated from college. The college graduated him. Harvard graduated 800 new doctors, but not he graduated college. That's still not totally accepted.
All right, but it is, we're just hearing it a lot more.
We do hear it a lot, and actually somebody wrote about that to me most recently after seeing it in The New Yorker.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Lulu graduated from college. Lulu was graduated from college. The college graduated Lulu, but questionable is still Lulu graduated college. I do want to add, at least one major American dictionary does accept that, but the others still haven't joined in, so.
All right, so maybe that'll be for the fifth
edition. I'm not joining in
edition.
Either.
Woe is I. I find
oh,
it
dear.
So interesting. You know, my daughter's 13 years old, and she will say things, and she hasn't said that particular phrase, but she will use phrases that I don't use. And I think it's interesting how the language evolves and where these influences come from, because I guess I thought maybe I was the number one influence on the way that my children speak. But
well,
but
you know, when you were her age, you probably said a lot of things that were jarring to your parents.
Yeah, so, I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
All right. Bob is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Pat, and hi, Charity. You do a great show. I love it. I understand, and I am with it that language is going to change and evolve, and I think it's great and it should. But I think as lovers of language, we need to be careful and try at least to make it more precise and more useful and not less useful. And kind of to that end, I've got a couple of words that I hear used by media all the time, and therefore the public at large. Daunting does not mean challenging, and reticent does not mean reluctant. I hear those all the time, and I believe we're losing the meanings of those words.
Well, you may be right. Actually, I did address reluctant and reticent in the book, and I agree with you. Reluctant does not mean the same thing as reticent. Reticent means you're not talking about something, or you're not revealing. Reluctant means you're unwilling. I didn't get into daunting. But I didn't realize that that was on the radar, that a lot of people are using that in a weird way.
That's interesting.
Haven't heard that.
Yeah, well, and Pat, you write about a lot of different words in the book that have shifted over time and some that are hard for us to accept.
I mean,
for example, unique, it's now acceptable to use the word unique to mean remarkable and not what it used to be, which was one of a kind.
I know. Regrettably, I have to add that. I don't like it either. So I don't want people to think that I'm just waiting to pounce on new usages and say they're great, because I liked unique the way it was before. but I think what's happened is people started thinking of unique as a sort of spectrum of remarkableness. They didn't think of it as at the peak. They thought of it as unique. You can be sort of unique. It'd be really unique, kind of unique. That there were degrees of it, and there are degrees of remarkableness. So I can understand why these things evolve. Although, if you really want to be precise, I mean, I wouldn't say something was sort of unique, because I don't like using them
right.
that way.
Again, you don't have to use them even if they're acceptable, right?
True.
Well, and you included one in the book, and I thought, oh, I thought that one has been okay for a long time. The use of fun as an adjective, which is something
that was always a bugaboo. Maybe I'm more familiar with that because I used to be a copy editor. But any copy editor would tell you, oh, no, fun is not an adjective. It's a noun. It's something, it's a quality, or it's something, it's amusement. It's this or that. But no, it's now officially accepted as an adjective that can modify, like, we had a fun vacation, we had a fun time, was it a fun party? That used to be unacceptable, and now it's acceptable. But I want to say, it's not an adjective of degree. In other words, you can't say, it was the funnest party, or it was we had a funner vacation this year. So it's not fully really an adjective. A linguist will say a real adjective is one that has degrees, that you could say funner and funnest, like big, bigger, biggest. But it's not acceptable in that way yet.
All right.
Just as a bare adjective.
So we still get to keep correcting children on that one, at least.
Yes.
All right. Joan is on the line in Ankeny, and she's going to give you an opportunity to talk about a subject that you have a lot of fun with in the book, which is the word me. But we'll let Joan introduce the subject first. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I'm enjoying your program. I always do when I get a chance to listen to it. I recently read Michelle Obama's book, and in it, this person who has several college degrees and is a very, I love her dearly, but she talked about me and Barack did this, and me and my girlfriends did this, and me and so-and-so did this, and it just grates on me, and I know a lot of people do that. I correct my grandkids when they say me and my friend are doing this. I say, who? And now they know, my friend and I. Is that acceptable now?
Well, no. Is she really using me as a subject? You sure about that?
Yes. She says, me and Barack did this. Me and my girlfriends decided to do this. Me and my colleagues. It isn't a one-time deal. Mm. And I would think her editor would catch it if she, and like I said, I know lots of people do that, but oh my.
Well, I have to say, no, that's not acceptable to use me as a subject. But I would guess that the publishers did bring it up. I can't imagine that they wouldn't, or that the copy editor on the book wouldn't bring it up, that it would, it's so obvious. And she probably said, I want this as
conversational
English. I want to be casual. And that's her choice. And writers do make these choices. But I would say no. In ordinary English, me is not a subject. But I do want to say a few words about that. Somebody wrote to me last month, and my husband and I answered on our blog. Someone said in Michelle's new memoir, Becoming, she uses this sentence to describe the sacrifices her parents made in raising her and her brother Craig, and I'll quote, "We were their investment, me and Craig." And the reader said, surely that should be Craig and I. Now, there are two reasons here that I'm sure the person is objecting both to the use of me and to the use of the fact that the pronoun comes first. So I'll address those one at a time. I think she was right here. I think this is a correct sentence. Because in that sentence, the word me, the pronoun, has no distinct grammatical role in the sentence. And I actually added a section in my book about this. I hadn't covered it before, and it's not really that new. Linguists have known about this for a while, but when you're faced with a choice of pronoun, I or me, we or us, they or them, but I or me is usually the one it comes up with. Grammarians now say that when the pronoun has no distinctly defined role in the sentence, the default choice is me. That in English, the natural choice is the default object. And this is true in a lot of languages. In French, moi, they don't say je, they say moi. This explains why it's natural to us to say things like, lucky me, me turned down a free lunch, me too. Someone might say, I want to go to a movie, me too. You don't say I too. It's me. You say. So this, I mean, there are a lot of examples of this. And why does me come to the come to your tongue automatically when you, there's no distinctly defined role? Well, now linguists are thinking that probably the object case is the natural default in English, as it is in some other languages. So that's why I think me was correct as she used it. We were their investment, me and Craig. I think me was correct there.
And,
now,
and
as
we
far
do
as
tend
she has said,
avoid it more than, you know, those of us who are trying to be proper, we avoid it more than we should.
Probably. A lot of people go overboard. They become hypercorrect. They put I in a place where me, it would be the normal choice, where it's actually an object case pronoun that you need. We find a lot of that. But another misconception people have about I and me is that, well, you know, they'll think I is generally better, a better choice than me, as in, come with Frank and I to the movies. That should be Frank and me. But another thing they think is that the pronoun should come last. I once said on the radio, not on your show, but this was years ago, I made a reference to me and my husband, and it was in the object case. I said, this was hard for me and my husband to discuss. And someone said, shouldn't you have said my husband and me, not me and my husband? No, there is no grammatical foundation for the belief that when you have a first-person pronoun in a sentence and it's compounded with a another name, that you make the pronoun last. That's just a matter of order. There may be a politeness there, a politeness issue, but there's no grammatical rule about it.
All right. So we're overthinking that in a lot of cases.
True. But that said, I want to say that when the pronoun is I, it does seem to fall naturally into the number two spot. Tom and I are going, not I and Tom are going.
Right. The so trust your instincts on that one for sure.
True.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. We've got next up Mike on the line in Ames. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I actually have two questions. The first one, I've seen like in the last 5 to 10 years, mostly in kind of informal written communications like emails, sometimes spoken, where people drop to be. Like, the vegetables need washed. Mm-hmm. I always cringe when I hear that or read that.
Yeah, that's actually a very old usage. Has nothing to do with the internet. A lot of people have suggested that it's regional, but I haven't seen any evidence for that. It's all over the place.
Personally, I have interviewed someone who studied regional dialects, and he did include that in a Midwestern regional dialect. So, I mean, it's something that we do commonly hear in this part of the country.
Right. Needs washed, needs fixed, and so on. It's an accepted regionalism. It's not considered incorrect. But I agree with you that if I were writing something formally, I wouldn't say, oh, my hair needs washed. I would say my hair needs to be washed, just because I'm a little more careful when I write than when I speak.
And most of us are.
Most of us are, yeah.
you had a second one, Mike?
Yeah, thanks. The other one is around use of myself. Like, I hear this a lot, and I always roll my eyes. If you have any questions, please direct them to John or myself. And I'm always like, you know, myself, if myself is asking a question, I'm asking it to myself. I'm not asking you.
Right. Now, that should be if you were choosing a pronoun, the better one would be me. But a lot of people are reluctant to use me because they wonder if maybe I would be more correct, so they choose myself to be on the safe side.
And you have a whole section in your book entitled Self-Denial. Yes. This is one of your pet peeves, too, I take it.
It is. It is. People overuse it. And I think, come on, I think it's just me avoidance. People just don't want to use me for some reason. They think there's something wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a perfectly correct pronoun. It has a lot of uses. We'd be lost without it. You don't need to resort to myself because you're unsure. I'll tell you one hint. If a pronoun comes at the very end of a sentence, it's probably me. A first-person pronoun. It's probably me. Very seldom would you find I at the end of a sentence.
All right, so it's a good
shortcut. Go ahead and use me at the end.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Patricia O'Connor and me on the show today. You're welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Patricia has just released the fourth edition of her grammar guide, Woe Is I. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about changes to the English language. Patricia O'Connor is here. She's just released the fourth edition of her best-selling book, Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Patricia, you included a section in the book with changes to spelling and pronunciation, which that was so interesting to me because, some of these things shift and you don't even think about it over time.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some of the words that have changed. I mean, canceled is one that changed over time. And I find myself constantly questioning how to spell it. And now I know why I was asking the question.
Right. There are a couple of the of words in there, like benefited. Now it's acceptable with two T's, and canceled is now acceptable with two L's. Now the American spellings used to have just one. Benefited had one T, canceled had one L, and I well remember this because for years as a copy editor I was fixing those. Now, it turns out that those were, the double consonants were the preferred British spellings. So they didn't just come out of the blue. It's just that those were the way they evolved in American dictionaries after the Revolution. So now it makes things easier for all of us that the two T benefited and the two L canceled. Now, one that I find jarring, this is another one, buses. The plural of buses used to be B-U-S-E-S. It's now accepted with two S's in the middle, B-U-S-S-E-S. This is going to be hard for me to get used to, but the two S one, B-U-S-S-E-S, two S's in the middle, is now an acceptable variant. It's not equally, they're not equal variants. The one with the extra S is a little bit less common than the other one, but buses can now be spelled with two S's. So
all right.
When I see it on a sign, I'm not going to want to go up and cross it out with magic marker anymore.
You may still want to. But
yeah.
You have a whole list of commonly misspelled words, which I thought was very funny because you were writing in the book about how when you try to write the word substitution, you always write it incorrectly. And so
my fingers get tangled up.
Right.
The same with institution. I can't write it correctly.
So for me, it's guarantee, and I was so happy to see that on your list. I'm like, well, at least I'm not alone. That's the word that trips me up every time.
Right. Now, there aren't many new pronunciations newly acceptable, but one of them is grocery with a sh in the middle, grocery. Now, growing up in Des Moines, and probably everywhere else I lived in Iowa, which is, I guess, just Waterloo. But anyway, I always heard grocery, and I always said grocery. So it was kind of gratifying to me to find that this is now an acceptable pronunciation. It's not just considered a regional variation. So it's acceptable now to say groceries, or groceries.
All right, so we're all correct now.
We're all correct.
What a relief.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Melody is on the line in Dexter. Hi, Melody. Oh, maybe Melody is not there. How about Stan in Rock Island? Hi, Stan.
Hi, I'm here.
All right, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about apostrophe abuse. This isn't exactly grammar, of course, but I've been seeing a lot of, the temperature will be in the 20s today, 20 apostrophe S. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there were these TV shows in the 70s, 70 apostrophe, or somebody's recorded 5 CD apostrophe S. That isn't becoming acceptable now, is it? I hope not.
No. Well, it's not. I don't accept it in my book. With numbers, there's no need to put an apostrophe before your S. Similarly, with capital letters, if you use a capital letter and a small S, there's no need to put an apostrophe. Now, if you were writing in all caps, of course, I wouldn't recommend that anyway, but if for some reason, say you were doing a sign, had to be in all caps, CDS, would look very funny. So in that case, you might want to slip an apostrophe in just to make sure that it was readable. But one thing to keep in mind about apostrophe use, and I take apostrophes very seriously because there is one in my name, and nobody gets it right. When I spell it to people on the phone, they say, "What was that second letter?" I say, "Apostrophe." They don't even know what it is. So, you know, I'm not taking this lightly, but apostrophes, punctuation in general is not written in stone. It's a style issue, and it varies from publisher to publisher. I took the majority view, and I generally, when there's a disagreement, I come down on the side of the most recent edition of the Chicago Manual of Style because it's used by a lot of major academic publishers. So I don't think you need an apostrophe with numbers, and I don't think you need them with a capital letter. So I agree with you there.
All right, and we also just see them, the possessive apostrophe used wrong
time. Yeah, possessives do not have an apostrophe.
All right.
There's been a whole book written about that, a very shrill book.
All right, let's. Melody is back on the line now in Dexter. Hi, Melody.
Yeah, hi. Sorry about that. I didn't get my mute off quick enough. So thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I moved here from Missouri with my parents several years ago, and we noticed when we got to Iowa, a lot of times people would end a sentence with. And in Missouri, we would typically say, "Do you want to go with me?" Or can you go with me? And in Iowa, it was typical that they would just say, "Do you want to go with?" And I was just wondering, I'm assuming that's a regionalism, but I was just hoping you could clarify that for me.
Right. Yeah, this is an example of ellipsis, or an elliptical way of expressing yourself. It's more common, I think, on the East Coast. I didn't hear it that much in Iowa when I was growing up there, but I did hear it a lot on the East Coast, "go with." Another one you'd hear is, "Let's meet for coffee and." So they wouldn't say coffee and donuts or something. Coffee and just meant coffee and maybe something else if you want it. So It's just sort of a clipped form of expression. It's not wrong. And they generally wouldn't write that way. It's generally a speech thing.
Right. We take all kinds of shortcuts when we speak.
Yes.
All right. It's interesting, the difference between Missouri and Iowa on that
It is. Now, I wanted to talk about one particular verb past tense that's newly acceptable.
Okay.
Because it has a lot of interest in the development of English. This is the word, the past tense dove, for dive. Now, typically, the past tense of dive has been dived. And dove was frowned upon. Now, there's a little background to this. Typically, in a Germanic language like English, verbs fall mostly into one of two classes. They're typically called strong and weak. The strong verbs form the past tense by a change in the vowel, as in speak, spoke, drive, drove, sing, sang, give, gave, take, took, break, broke, all those sorts of verbs. Those are considered strong. Weak verbs form the past tense just by adding an ending, usually ed, as in walk, walked, play, played, move, moved, and so on. Now, the tendency over the centuries has been for the strong verbs to become weak and develop ed endings in modern English. For example, the past tense of step used to be stop. We're talking about centuries ago. But in modern English, it became stepped. And that was generally the trend with verbs. However, dive is a weak verb. It started out as dived. So the development of dove runs counter to the tendency of change in English verb forms. Hmm. It's very interesting, not only that it should develop, but that it should develop this late. Now, another example of a similar change was wear. The verb wear, as in to wear a coat, W-E-A-R. Now, it originally was a weak verb, and the past tense was weared. It changed around the 16th century to wore. So that's another case where it's just changing its vowel instead of adding the ed to become the past tense. And it did that by analogy with words, verbs like swear, swore, bear, bore, tear, tore. But that happened in the 16th century. It's odd that it would happen with dove. This is a very, it's a significant development. There's more to it than just, oh, it's an old, that's a slang past tense, and now it's considered okay.
Well, and snuck is also on this list, right, for the past
True.
Tense of sneak.
True. The past tense of sneak is the proper, you might say, is sneaked. Now, the usage snuck, it began as an Americanism. It was first introduced in the 1800s. Because it was introduced that late, people jumped on it with both feet and said, ah, snuck, that's terrible. Now, it probably arose in imitation of the pattern set by stick, stuck. Strike, struck, and those sorts of verbs that just change their vowel sound. Now, widespread use of snuck, according to people who track this kind of thing, it gradually became more common with every generation of American speakers. It's now used, dictionaries are saying, it's now used by educated speakers in all regions of the country. Therefore, it enters the dictionaries as a correct usage. Of course, the more traditional form sneaked, it still predominates in British English. That's also fully acceptable.
All right.
But we have
you
a
don't
choice.
Have to stop using that, but
no.
A lot of us have been using snuck anyway. So
right. The thing to keep in mind is that these kinds of changes don't just come out of nowhere. There are reasons for them.
Right.
It's not just lazy tongue.
All right, Brenda is on the line in Preston. Hi, Brenda.
Hi. I have just been made aware, or I have become aware. I don't know even how to speak to you now. But I have become aware of people in the media not using past participles of verbs correctly. And many times, not exclusively, but many times you hear it with sports commentators, and they'll say they've went, or he's ran, or she's wrote. And they don't use the past participle form. And I understand that the helping verb is contracted here. They're using it as in a contracted form.
Sure.
But I've heard it on national TV. I've heard it on the regular old-fashioned networks. I've heard it on cable TV. And I'm just concerned that people are giving up on past participles.
Oh, no, I don't think they're giving up on past participles. I get a lot of mail about stuff like that. Just because a sportscaster says something doesn't make it right. Even if all sportscasters start using it, pay no mind. She's went, that will never be correct English, I hope, at least in my lifetime. Of course, there's not that much of my lifetime left, but I would be very surprised if that ever happened.
Now, we have talked about sportscasters in the past on this program because some very interesting things come out of their mouths. And I do, as a live broadcaster myself, I have to defend them a little bit in saying that when you have to say that much that fast, sometimes things happen.
That's very true. That's very true. And when I get very excited, you'd be surprised what comes out of my mouth.
I think all of us have had those experiences.
That's true. And when they're doing play-by-play, I have to hand it to them that they not only can announce these things that are happening all of a sudden, but they can keep droning on and on when there's nothing happening. I didn't watch the Super Bowl, but
not a lot happened.
It was a very one-sided game. I mean, how would you keep it up? So, I sympathize with them, but no, she's went, he's went, she's wrote, no way.
Well, we didn't get an opportunity to talk about all of the changes that have come about between the third edition and the fourth edition of Woe Is I, and hopefully we will talk about those on future programs, Pat. But it does strike me that in a period of 10 years, there has been a lot of change. I know we have a living language, but it's changing faster than many of us might
think. I know. This was the biggest overhaul that I've done. I was shocked. The more I got into it, I re-researched everything, every single word that was in the previous book, and I was shocked at how much was different. Because, you know, I'm not always I don't look up things like dove unless somebody asks me, and so suddenly I look it up and I find, wow, all dictionaries now accepted. Who knew? So, yeah, English is always taking me by surprise, but there are always reasons for it. It's not a messy, untidy language, as a lot of people seem to think.
It's fascinating, sometimes beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
certainly worth exploring. Patricia O'Connor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Patricia O'Connor, our English language expert. She has just published the fourth edition of her best-selling grammar guide, Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. And she stops by every couple of months to talk about the English language with us. She also blogs at grammarphobia.com, so you can send your questions directly to her. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.